Hi, this is John Udell, and today's podcast is an interview with Chris Cemignani. He and his brother Zach started a company called Juice Analytics. They're both practitioners of and advocates for a more agile way of visualizing and analyzing business data.
You're serious about making this John's Radio.
Yeah, that's funny, huh?
You know, live up to your name.
Yeah. So anyway, it's nice to finally sort of meet.
Yeah.
I was looking back at how our paths kind of intersected, and I guess the first time was when Paul Kodrosky did that bit of flash visualization of the Tiger Woods golf data. Struck a chord with me because I'm always annoyed at how poorly we visualize data, and in particular how we seldom make effective use of animation. And so I thought it was cool that he did the flash thing, and then you came in with the Excel version of the exact same thing, which was interesting in two different ways. One of them, you know, just that it was possible to do that. I mean, I'm not the only person who made the comment that, geez, you know, I mean, I should know that it's possible to do that kind of thing in Excel, but I sure don't. The other interesting thing to me about it was how effectively the screencast that you made served as a teaching tool. So that when I went back and recreated what you had done, I did it just by following along in the screencast.
But yeah, the Paul Kodrosky post was really a kind of a slow pitch into the sweet spot of what we do, partly.
Uh-huh.
So one thing that is certainly missing from Excel is there's no sense of animation. And while that's not Paul Kodrosky's thing, wasn't exactly the most revealing use of animation, still better to have some ability to animate than none. And the other thing that struck me about his post is, you know, he did it in Flash, but you've got about 90% of the audience is not going to be able to follow along with something that's done in Flash. And, you know, Excel really is the ubiquitous business tool for dealing with data. And
well, because you have the data as well at your disposal, which is, of course, the thing that you don't get just with the animation. So
right.
And well, let's kind of back up and go through sort of how you, I guess I would characterize what you and your brother are doing as a kind of a boutique consultancy in the area of analytics. And, you know, I really like the phrase agile analytics that you guys have come up with. I think it rings a lot of bells anyway for me and presumably for other people. But why don't you kind of lead into how you got to where you guys are and what you're focusing on?
Sure. Both Zach and I have experience in a corporate environment. I worked in the credit card industry for quite a number of years. So we've seen a lot about how analytics and learning about customers takes place kind of in the field, on the screens of people. And I had done some stuff in some of my previous jobs where I was trying to do much richer data visualization of customer behavior. And that was, you know, it was exciting for both of us. And I think we found we had the opportunity to strike out on our own, doing analytics consulting for companies. There are a lot of companies now that are collecting a lot of customer data. And I would just hazard to guess that it's kind of exploded over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
As more stuff goes web-based, and you've got click logs and all that kind of stuff to deal with. So people are collecting this stuff, and the systems haven't really advanced to getting that much insight out of it.
Well, it's pathetic. I mean, we're basically stuck with the handful of stock charts, and, you know, that's just not really very helpful at all. And I guess, you know, I guess it just takes a kind of an interesting skill set. So you guys, I would say, are sort of, you know, quants on the one hand and you know, programmers on the other hand, but also you bring, I think there's kind of a creative sensibility that's needed here, because it really, a lot of this, I think, is pretty much uncharted territory, you know, in terms of bringing alternative and more effective ways of visualizing data into the mainstream of business.
One thing that I think is true, you had a post just on your weblog a little while ago about how your superpower was being able to kind of carry data across different boundaries, or I forget exactly what you said, but
yeah, you're in the same
I'm
club.
Really in the same boat, where I think you, and this is even more true in big businesses, but you have a lot of people that are specialists, and they only work on one system, or they, you know, they're analysts, but they don't do the database work. And, you know, I've always been a generalist myself and worked with, tried to build a really wide tool set for doing things. And so we kind of bring that to bear. One of the things we do is we try and pull all of a company's data about its customers from all these different siloed systems into a single kind of data set, and then from there we build these customer level data sparkline. It's one of these things you talk about how it's kind of pathetic how there hasn't been much innovation in how to view data.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think we are starting to see some new ways of viewing data start to become at least common knowledge. So stuff like tag clouds, more and more people are coming into contact with those, or tree maps,
mm-hmm.
that you've seen. But
there's a handful of new widgets on the scene.
There's some, but you know, we probably went for about 10 or 15 years without any real new user interface widgets.
Yeah, exactly.
And more consumer-facing applications are getting kind of slick, flash-based interfaces, and I think that's going to eventually kind of push up to enterprise apps.
Well, here's my theory. See what you think about it in terms of, you know, what would be the benefit of delivering office-like technology through the web? And I think people tend to focus on a lot of the obvious benefits having to do with, you know, total cost of ownership and just ease of deployment and administration. And those are definitely valid benefits, but people are right to point out that you're also sort of giving away a lot of the power of the fat client applications, you know, because even though, well, it's sort of a paradox, right, because people never manage to scratch more than the surface of things like Excel, but, you know, you know, there is lots of stuff under the hood there, as you've been,
right,
as you've been demonstrating, but, you know, it occurs to me that it's going to maybe come around from another direction, in the sense that what we have when we do things through the web is an environment in which, you know, whatever it is that can be accomplished is almost by definition shareable. If things were shareable, or, you know, are shareable in the Excel environment, but not in the same way. And I think that's what we kind of need, because people need to see things that other people are doing and then riff off of them with their own things. Kind of like that little exchange that we had actually a couple of times, right? Somebody did a tag cloud thing, I did a tag cloud thing, you did a tag cloud thing. You know, we were kind of riffing back and forth on it. And in an environment where the web is providing the playground in which everyone can do that together, I think it could get us to a place where we see a lot of accelerated innovation. At least that's my hope.
I think that's one of the frustrations I have with Excel is it's kind of a missed opportunity. First of all, I want to emphasize how really ubiquitous it is in a corporate environment. That,
yep,
you really will find people working in Excel all day long. And you know, they also used to work in Word, but now they're sending emails. But Excel is still there at the center point of what people are doing. But Microsoft is rolling out Excel 2007, and I don't really think they're not making it easier to share. They're making it more powerful.
Yeah.
But they're not. But again, those powerful features aren't what people use. People need a simpler set, and you know, one of the reasons Excel is so popular is it gives a non-programmer. It's sort of like what MySQL is to, you know, Linux heads. It's just a place where you can store your data. You don't have to think about it, and you can dump some data in there. It's real easy to manipulate. Another thing we've seen often, we find when you're trying to do analysis in the workplace environment, the problem is really getting hold of the data and finding the right way to look at the data.
Uh-huh.
It's not a problem of statistical sensitivity or things being really all that subtle once you actually get your hands on the data, but the problem is actually finding the right way of looking at the data.
Well, that is a pretty subtle thing, don't you think? I mean, there are lots of relatively useless ways to chart numbers, and not a whole lot of ones that produce novel insight.
Yes. We've done a lot of, on the one hand, high-end exploration with what you can do with Excel charting.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's pretty crazy. But also one of our frustrations with Excel is a lot of the built-in charts are just, there's a lot that's been learned over the last 20 years about how to make a good chart and make it easy for people to read. And the built-in charts are just not effective at communicating.
And so you don't mean in terms of different chart types than the ones that are available. You're just talking about the execution of the ones that are in the kit.
Yeah, the execution of the ones that are in the kit. I think there's a little bit of a sense of, from Microsoft's part, that we'll give you a huge palette of pretty things to choose from. But there's not much that's done to narrow down what would the right chart to be looking at this point in time be with this data.
Mm-hmm. So if you were the czar of Microsoft Excel, what would you focus on doing?
No, I think there may be room with Excel to split it into some different tools. Excel tries to wrap up all these different kinds of functionality into one package.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is an ability to split out a version of Excel that's useful mainly for holding on to a chunk of data and doing basic formula stuff. And some of the more, a lot of the advanced functionality that they're putting into this next version, I don't think that average business folks are actually going to be able to use.
Yeah.
It would be nice to see some concept of a kind of a lightweight Excel that didn't give as many options to people,
right?
But actually gave tried to push people in a good direction.
It seems to me that part of the problem that we have in general with these complicated software packages is that people don't get much of an opportunity to observe other people using tools. And it's occurred to me that that's maybe one of the most interesting uses of screencasting, because, you know, in general, the way that we as human beings learn new behaviors is by, you know, emulation of other people who we see doing stuff. So, you know, I've sometimes given this example of the ape and the termite stick, right? Which is to say that the first time an ape saw another ape use a termite stick to feed himself, it was like, wow, you know, I'm going to get one of those. You know, and you know, that's a lesson I'm not going to forget.
Right.
But you know, the way things are set up right now, if you think about it, we all sort of work in a fairly isolated way, right? Which is to say, we're not looking over one another's shoulders very much. I've also thought about this in the context of pair programming, right? That,
yeah,
you know, a lot of that is just literally, you know, being able to observe the unconscious knowledge that the other person has, right? And to absorb it by seeing it, and, you know, to get ideas that wouldn't have occurred to you, answer questions that you never would have asked, just by seeing things happen. I seriously have wondered why, since everybody knows that, you know, 90%+ of the functionality of Office is below the tip of the iceberg and no one sees it, and they particularly don't see it in contexts where, you know, they have a need and then they see the solution, right? Which would really sort of, which is really how learning happens and how knowledge is acquired and sticks.
I think that's one thing we would like to do with our blog is, I think there's been a lot of communication and conversation in the programming world about, among kind of geeks, about different ways of getting work done. So you have, mm-hmm, all these extreme programming and a lot of different methodologies for how to do work and personal productivity and, you know, a lot of rich conversations about. People are, you know, just out there talking to each other, but a lot of people inside of the business are just coming to this, and they haven't really been exposed to it very much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Agile Analytics, for instance, going back to that, you know, that's a riff directly off of Agile development,
mm-hmm,
methodologies. And I think it's good because I think, you know, there's been all this innovation in ways to do development, but more and more the business environment is for average business folks is looking like a little bit like a software development shop. You know, you when you devise, create a strategy, it's going to have to be implemented in Silicon.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to kind of be familiar with those methodologies.
Yeah, and it's been fascinating to watch you guys kind of open a window onto ways of thinking about things and ways of doing things that are not normally exposed. It's tremendously interesting to me, and like you, I would envision that becoming a more common behavior, you know, that there can be, you know, that there's a lot of potential collaboration and cooperation. You know, that's historically happened, you know, to some extent on the internet, right? I mean, that's, you know, what interest groups have always done, you know, but they've always done it in the medium of text. And, you know, in particular, you know, when we're talking about things like software behaviors and the analysis of data and, you know, all of the things that go on in those realms, text alone isn't the ideal medium to convey knowledge and technique. And so actually, you know, I really would look toward a time in the not too distant future where it's relatively routine for people to do more of the kind of capturing and sharing that you've been doing. But I'd be interested to hear, you know, what your experience has been with that, because it certainly is, you know, a whole new set of challenges in terms of, you know, mastering the techniques that make it possible to do that communication, right? So what's been your experience with that?
Well, I was around, I was reading your blog when you were coining this term. So right away I was like, yeah, that's clear that this is going to be something that's cool and easy to do. And actually, it's nice in a sense. I find it easier in some senses to do a screencast, even though it can take a little bit longer to actually set up and produce.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what's going to be out there is something that someone can follow along directly, whereas it may take you two pages of words to describe the technique that you're trying to describe. And you know, words are necessarily imprecise, and so if someone runs off the rails at a certain point, they don't necessarily know that where they went wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an either-or thing. It's just that, as usual, right, nothing ever goes away. You just add on more stuff, and it's really exhilarating, but it's also kind of threatening to people. You know, if you now present them with, you know, there's just a whack of stuff, you know, that it's on the one hand possible to do and really empowering to get your hands around, but on the other hand, I think fairly challenging. You know,
but these things will get easier over time.
Yeah.
Writing a blog used to be a challenge, and now people just go to Blogspot.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, I think as long as you don't ask people to edit very much, and I pretty much don't edit what I produce for screencasts.
Mm-hmm.
Then
yeah, if you do short ones like you've been doing,
you keep it short. You talk really fast. Then.
But it is it's a remarkable thing.
People don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
If you read 43 folders,
mm-hmm.
then you know Merlin over there has really been pushing a wonderful concept that you know all this email sucks, and people didn't know it sucked until he started telling them. They might have had some sense it sucked, but. And there are appropriate techniques for dealing with it. And so I think a little bit of what we would ever hope for our site is to be a little bit like 43 folders for the office set,
mm-hmm.
where you know there's a lot of stuff that people do in Excel. I hate to keep banging on that because that's not the only thing we do. We have other skills too. But you know, people spend all afternoon trying to get some data reformatted in some particular way in Excel. And it's this kind of thing, if they had the right tools, it would take them a minute.
Yeah, and not having occurred to them that such solutions exist, you know, they just persist in doing the same old repetitive, time-wasting thing, right? And if you can break that cycle.
In offices throughout America, this is happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Today,
I know.
At this very moment.
As we speak.
someone is wasting their time.
You know, I mean, I've thought sometimes about if you could recover the economic value of all of the time that people spend when replying to emails, reformatting the quoted text.
Yeah.
It would probably be the GDP of several small nations. So I wanted to ask you to circle back to your credit card days.
Sure.
You had mentioned feeling kind of scarred by the OLAP wars. It sounded like an interesting thing to hear about.
I know it sounds dramatic.
I'm sure it is in some ways.
I'm sure I can make it dramatic if I push hard enough. I guess what Zach and I both feel is there's kind of a current best practice for dealing with data in an organization, and that is that you have all these production systems, and on the back end you build an enterprise data warehouse, which is this sort of enormous data store that all this information flows into. And then on top of that, you land at some sort of OLAP reporting solution like Business Objects or Cognos.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, and we've seen this in action and have felt really unsatisfied by it. I was actually involved in with one client, not my proudest moment, is we were designing a in-house data mart and spent most of a year actually building this thing and speccing out all the different sources that do this. And this is a large client, so there's a lot of internal layers to deal with, and nothing happens all that fast. And spent most of the year actually delivering this, and right when it was delivered, the organization went through a reorg, and this whole data mart does about maybe $1 million of spend and effort just fell on the ground, no one there to catch it because no one needed it anymore. This actually happened twice at this organization, two times in a row. And so you have this, for one thing, when you have this concept, this sort of monolithic approach, you have to deal with whether or not your technical cycle has to operate more quickly than your business cycle. So if you reorg every 6 months and to go in a new direction, which might be a perfectly valid thing to do, then you're going to find all these technical projects are going to wind up getting orphaned.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a little bit of the motivation behind this Agile analytics and saying, why get all bent out of shape trying to create a single version of the truth when you're kind of zigzagging anyway and you don't quite know where you're going to end up?
Do you think I think you're probably right that the single version of truth is the illusory holy grail that drives a lot of those efforts? Is that a fair statement?
Yes. I think that an awful lot of emphasis is placed on that. I do think it's largely a sort of a false premise, because even if you have the same number, you actually, if you can report some given number, there's many more questions about how that number actually came to be.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has to put a really rich context around what does this number actually mean, and what does it mean to me in my job function?
Yes. Yes. This is a hard conversation to have in some circles because
absolutely.
You know, because somebody always snaps back and says, well, I mean, you know, your bank account either is or isn't what it should be, right? And do you think that there's any room for error there? And it's like, no, I don't. It's, but, you know,
right.
You know.
But it's different when you're dealing with an organization of 20,000 people with a lot of different responsibilities, and you know, the operations people have a specific set of goals that are important to them, and the marketing people have another set of goals, and so sometimes people really flip out when you're reporting numbers and one set of numbers doesn't tie to another set of numbers, but there often are reasons for those individual perspectives.
So what's been your best way of getting at the context?
What we like to do is try and come at the problem from a bottom-up perspective. We don't solve all these problems, but try and start from the customer first and work your way toward a common understanding. First of all, this whole concept of coming back to the single version of the truth, creating a single understanding of the customer, for instance, in a company, it's a social undertaking, not a technical undertaking.
And what would you mean by that?
You don't have a single understanding of who your customers are just because you have a single database that stores your customers.
Mm-hmm.
What it means is that at this company, we understand how our best customers behave and how our best customers use our service.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand how our worst customers behave and how they use our service.
Mm-hmm.
We have sort of a clear feeling that allows me to say, when I see someone doing something, this is a good customer, this is a bad customer.
Mm-hmm. So this is still in many cases quantitative, but there are also, I'm guessing, are lots of kind of qualitative or more narrative ways of getting at these behaviors.
Yeah, let me cycle back to this approach. So what we do is we grab all the different data from all the different data silos we can from an organization and build a comprehensive view of what a customer is doing,
mm-hmm.
and try and build that visually into a picture,
mm-hmm.
such that there are 10,000 customers. We'll be creating 10,000 pictures that show those customers' behaviors over time. And then where you go from there is you can kind of flip through those and visually try and recognize what's the difference between someone who's good for my company and someone who's not.
So this is kind of a Tuftian small multiple,
yes.
sort of a deal where you...
And then you can look at it in different... We build a web interface in front of this so that you can look at a whole lot of small multiples of these little pictures,
mm-hmm.
and then zoom in and look at someone in more detail.
So this is really obviously hard to do just in the audio domain, but is it worth trying to characterize, you know, what those things are displaying? And
this is kind of a unscrambling the omelet approach to things, where traditional reporting is based on aggregates, where you're kind of saying, here's how many customers we have that are doing this, and here's how many we have that are doing that. But that is that's hiding behavior that's going on underneath those aggregates.
Yeah.
So one example we have a client that has a online schooling business.
Okay.
Students could subscribe to take a course, and there might be 90 lessons in the course.
Okay.
And they would take it over the course of, and they would take the course over the course of 6 months. They might take two lessons a week. And one thing we found when you look at that visually is you will see people that are falling behind in the course.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be taking two or three lessons a week, and they're only taking one. They're not able to quite do it on time. And then you'll see them as they get toward the end of the course, they get kind of stressed, and you'll see them complete 30 lessons in a single day.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're saying if you just aggregated all that, you wouldn't see those individual patterns?
That would kind of get compressed out, and you would just see.
Yeah.
So those 30 completed lessons, you don't know that those are actually, that's not actually someone doing the work. That's someone gaming the system. Or, you know,
right.
themselves. But
Right.
So
is one of the ways that this can be described as an agile methodology that it's meaningful to do these individual cuts through the data set, you know, for relatively small samples? Like, you don't have to necessarily process everything. You can take, you know, you can take slices and get...
You could downsample this. But I think when we talk about the agile analytics, one of the main things we mean by that is that anytime you produce a report or you produce some sort of number, it's most of the time it's just going to generate more questions.
Right. So you want to get that iterative kind of thing going.
Can you build an analytics approach that supports iteration?
Yeah.
And a lot of the so-called kind of traditional approaches don't really support iteration because the data is aligned this one particular way. And so when a number is low, are you going to actually be able to investigate that and figure out what's going on? To do that might take some kind of simulation, or you're going to have to dig deeper or get down to the actual customer level and find out that a process is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And
it sounds like at the core of what you're talking about, then, are some relatively flexible data structures. What are those? I mean, what is the technology here that allows you to be more flexible?
So it comes down to how quickly can you take data out of all these systems and manipulate it and restructure it very quickly. So technically, on our side, we're using SAS
mm-hmm.
for a lot of this stuff
mm-hmm.
because I find the language is powerful and lets you work with large data sets.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are opportunities here as far as kind of in the future of analytics to come up with ways of gluing some of this stuff together. So I think I don't really think that the solution is more flexible programming tools. I think it's finding more ways to connect data in lightweight ways. We have another client that builds a kind of meta data warehouse on top of a bunch of existing systems, and they
mm-hmm.
they have this sort of RDF thing that describes, they extract data from a bunch of different silos, and then they've built this sort of map that says what all the data they've extracted means.
Really? So they're doing actual RDF processing over that?
Yes.
Really?
And it's really pretty interesting because, first of all, it preserves all the existing silos. And it's a very lightweight approach. They're working in a very limited problem domain.
Uh-huh.
So it's easy for them. They sort of, once they set up all the RDF, they don't have to adapt it all that much as they come into a completely new client.
And so they're running RDF queries and transformations?
Yes.
Using what?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I actually plan on interviewing one of these guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Into our blog, because it's such a wonderful example of this kind of agile approach. They can roll something out that allows a consolidated view across a bunch of different silos in like a week's time or a couple weeks' time instead of 12 months.
Hmm. Yeah, that does sound pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to be hearing from all of the RDF folks now. I know I periodically do. And they keep waiting for me to kind of see the light and, you know, get on board, which I probably will someday.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's nice, another thing that we recognize is it's certainly becoming, computational power is really remarkable these days. And so it's possible for me with a desktop PC to replicate a lot of what I was able to do at Citibank working on some kind of enormous parallel AS 4000
system. Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I can process hundreds of gigs of data on the desktop.
Yeah, and the amount that you can stick into memory is getting to be really interesting, too. I've just recently been feeling like we're on the verge of a huge amount of kind of in-memory database.
Yep.
You know, renaissance, right?
And so a lot of problem domains, if you're dealing with a business where you don't really have that much data, so
mm-hmm.
you have tens of thousands of customers and objects running around, but not tens of millions,
mm-hmm.
then all these new potentialities are going to be opening up.
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, it's actually, well, there's lots of ways in which we see this happening. I mean, I did this, you know, this metadata search thing for the InfoWorld site, and we just turned it on the other day, and the next day this guy wrote to me, and he's got this Ajax-style mashup that, you know, takes all the metadata into workstation memory and does, like, you know, lightning-fast interactive search, you know, with type ahead completion and stuff like that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, everybody has some kind of a working set, and with more and more RAM available, more and more of us can put more and more of those working sets in there and just party on the data, right?
Can I just stuff all that data into working memory? And if I can, then it doesn't matter how inefficient I am.
Yeah.
I can do any kind of crazy thing I want.
Yeah, yeah.
So fewer and fewer people are going to be the Citibanks of the world with, you know, 100 million customers.
So what are you feeling about the prospects for making better use of animation to get at the time dimension? I mean, you know, it seems so fundamental to me, you know, that, I mean, our brains are just hardwired, you know, to detect motion. That's just what our pattern recognizers do.
Yep.
And you know, yeah, we make hardly any use of that in any of our representations or analyses of data, right? I mean, where are the bottlenecks there? I think it must be a lot to do with tools and technologies, but also there's probably not enough ideas about again, you know, what's possible to do or what would be a good way to do it.
I think the consumer shall lead us. Where you probably have seen the new Google Finance application where they sort of let you.
Yeah.
They kind of did Oliver Steele's.
Yes, I know. It's very much like that.
They did it big time.
But that's not really an animation. That's more just a range selection.
You can kind of slide it back and forth, I guess.
Yeah, but that's not really, you know, that's not really show me this stuff changing over time, you know, or show me these things, you know, progressing through time in comparison to one another.
Yeah. Well, but you know, it's a missed opportunity for Excel, because I'm pretty sure it's not in Excel 2007, but the ability to lay out a graph and then choose one of the dimensions that are behind that graph and say animate this dimension would be really nice.
Well, you've shown how to do it, but hard way, right?
It's not that hard. And coming back around to Excel again is one of the Excel is just fairly hard to extend. You can write these add-ins, but you've got to deal with corporate security policies and all this kind of trouble. And if you allow me to be Excel czar again for a sec.
Yeah, you're king for a day.
All right. I think building out a lighter weight, more minimal application with the ability to do extensions and kind of grease monkey style stuff that Firefox has showed us can be done. I think that's the way you make stuff happen. And if you had that, then someone would figure out how to animate Excel charts. I mean, we know it's possible. And then 5 million people would be able to install that and get that running.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be you.
Maybe it'll be me. I don't know if you saw it, but I have a post very recently on a Excel chart cleaner.
I did see that.
A very important tool, I think, if you're into visualization.
Uh-huh.
If you're into making stuff look good.
Uh-huh.
Pretty easy to use tool that, in a more or less in a single click, lets you apply Tufte-style infographic quality to Excel charts.
Do you have before and after examples up there?
Screencast coming.
Yeah, okay.
And that, I think, will really help to explain the concept.
Uh-huh.
But just makes life easier. People, if you can make something just really easy for people to use, then they'll use it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, what we all imagine is that Apple Knowledge Navigator scenario, right, where you have this intelligent assistant, and you know, you say, you know, get me the Brazilian rainforest data, and there it is, right? Okay, now let's see that, you know, over this period of time. Okay, now factor out, you know, okay, right? I mean, we all sort of, you know, we've absorbed from science fiction this notion of what, you know, things could be in a world where the boundaries that separate the data silos are, you know, completely broken down, you know, and where these transformations are things that just kind of naturally occur instead of people like you and me having to roll up our sleeves, you know, and,
right.
you know, spend maybe not weeks, but at least hours accomplishing, you know, so that the whole thing is just kind of frictionless. And then we really do get to do that highly iterative and interactive exploration of scenarios. And, you know, gosh, we're just, we're still really awfully far away from that, aren't we? I mean,
well, yes, but there is a need for this. What Excel provides is sort of data canvas that a non-technical person can use.
Mm-hmm.
That can have all these pages and is essentially limitless. There's a real, that really connects with people, and people do understand that.
Yeah.
I'll close out with one final comment on that, because what I think is the problem is people don't really know what they need.
Right.
So how they're using it is not a great guide for how they should be using it, could be using it in the future.
Right.
And the exciting thing that we've seen with Firefox is you have an easy extension mechanism. You have all kinds of extensions being created. People try them out. There's lightweight to try them out. And then things that are good persist, and you can just harvest the best of the extensions to build the next version of your application.
So why is it so different then? Why is Firefox with GreaseMonkey so different than Excel with macros, which, by the way, are recordable, not possible in Firefox. Someone still has to hack up the GreaseMonkey code. So what is the difference there?
There is a big difference in mindset. Excel is not particularly friendly toward add-ins, I don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of a pain to create, as I decided to create one. And Excel likes to warn you, like, if you open a macro if you open a spreadsheet that has macros enabled in it, Excel does almost everything it can to sort of get you to, like, not open that file.
Well, you know, they've learned that lesson the hard way.
It's kind of user... and, okay, there's some good reasons, but it's kind of... All right, well, yeah.
Well, I guess we should wrap up.
Okay.
Okay, well, very good. Thanks a million.
We'll run into you sometime. We'll probably go to a conference sometime.
Which one? I wonder which one that would be.
I don't know. We're actually thinking of... we've been thinking a little bit about Wear 2.0, but...
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
We're working on some geographic. We do a lot of geographic... mashup.
I've seen some of that. Yeah, yeah, that would be a logical place for you to go.
It would.
And I didn't get to the last one, so it would be good to get to. Is that a summer thing?
It's a June 13th and 14th kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe I could.
The coming right up kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if we'll make it. We're busy right now.
Which is a good thing.
Busy.
Good problem to have.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks,